is my pleasure to introduce David G as our 10-minute speaker.
My name is David. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
Thank you for inviting me to speak. My sobriety date is May 9th of 2017, so 1 year and almost a month ago. Like some people, I really wasn't comfortable growing up with kids in my, the kids I was going to school with. Both my parents were school teachers, so I just busted my butt to be the super student and the teacher's pet. And if you're the teacher's pet, the rest of the kids in class, they're not so happy with you. Surprising how that works. And here I'm growing up with them, and, you know, a new teacher every year. When I got to adulthood, I still didn't feel comfortable in my own self and needed to do something so that I wouldn't be present here and now with just me. At first, that wasn't alcohol, but I lived my own life there for a good 15 years. Then I got married, and my wife had one rule: no alcohol, and stop doing the other stuff too. And I was fine with that. I was a stepdad. I had two boys, and I wanted to set a good example for them. But I learned now in AA is the term an obsession, right? There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't think to myself, man, it'll be great if I can smoke again. Man, I was just, for three years, I was kind of torturing myself. And one of the things that we had done is we decided to take the kids to church. They get a taste of Sunday school, and my wife and I found out we really liked church. The pastor did a sermon one time saying that God wants to help you and give you strength that you don't have. That evening, I got down on my knees, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was doing a small subset of the seven-step prayer. It worked. A week later, it's like, wow, I haven't thought of that in a week. And I'm like, thank you, Lord. I prayed sincerely, but it was the first evidence that I had that faith would work. There were things that happened later that were really painful, and then in 2009, our marriage didn't survive. Oh, you know what? This is silly. Hey, can I start my 10-minute timer now? How about if I run that down to there? It's nervous. It's funny. You get nervous. You like forget. I had a timer already. Things were really painful, and now I'm home alone every night, unsupervised, by myself, just alone. And I did turn to alcohol to drown my sorrows. And I did think at the time, well, if alcohol becomes a problem, I'll just quit, right? How many people have just, I'll just quit? By 2015, 2016, I knew I was in trouble. I had the shakes. I could tell I was slowly killing myself. I need to quit. But I knew nothing about AA, so I just quit. And I made it 6 weeks, guys. I really did. But as our book explains, we get restless, irritable, discontent. And by the end of that 6 weeks, I was just I was just too wound up, and I knew what would solve it, which was another drink. So then I'm off on a bender. Gotta quit again. I got 5 weeks. Then I got 4 weeks. Then I got 3 weeks. This trend is not going in my favor. When I got, I faced that moment of desperation, that incomprehensible demoralization when I couldn't get 24 hours. I was devastated, but I had to be honest. And so I ended up in the rooms of AA, and it was everything I needed. You guys were smiling. You were happy. I hadn't seen happiness in a decade. You guys told jokes with each other. You're genuinely friendly. You said, keep coming back. I really needed that. And then one of the things I was told, you need to get a sponsor. Well, my sponsor, he said, we need to work the steps. I don't have much time left. I'll real quick do one little ninth step I did this week. I had to make amends to Amazon. Indeed. Somewhere my alcoholic thinking had gotten the idea that if I called them up and said someone stole the package off my doorstep, they would ship me another one. And I have a stack of hard drives sitting on my table at home that every time I would look at them, it's like, oh, did I do that? Dang. So this week, I called up Amazon, and I had to explain, I'm in a recovery program, and I need to make amends. I need to give you your money back. And they charged my credit card. I think I got Amazon reward points for that. I'm not sure. But, you know, today, I can look at that stack of hard drives, and there's no guilt there, right? That guilt is relieved. That I am so thankful of that, and that's just one of the benefits I've gotten, and with that, I'm happy to keep coming back. Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gents, now it is my pleasure to introduce one of the few men that are still around that was here when I got here, and that's Rick D. Yeah.
My name's Rick Dickens, alcoholic.
Hi, Rick Dickens.
This is not the Alano Club either. We got a microphone that works. So.
Yeah. You don't have to get it right now.
Yeah, there you go. We were a little bit late. My sobriety date is April the 2nd, 1984, and that makes me about 34 years old.
Yeah.
And I am too laid back. We were here about 20 after 7 with my partner up here, and there was no one here. So I said, oh, crap, you know, we will go over here to the other church on Cross Street because they may be there. They ain't there. You know, so it's like bomb back to Visalia, get the phone, and I walk in the house, and my buddy Albert's on the phone, and he says, come back to Gem Street. So one of the things that we like to do is we go out and we kind of like tour around the countryside and just go for rides on the weekends and whenever we can and just kind of relax, you know, and it's really nice to be able to do that anymore, you know, instead of running from one bar to the other and driving like a maniac, yeah, you know, you get to see the damn corn grow. You know, and it's like, first of all, you know, like, geez, you see this, like, it wasn't here there last week, you know. I was born in Massachusetts, and I'm a product, I think, of an alcoholic father. He was in and out of the asylums to get dried out a lot, and he just couldn't seem to put it together, I guess, you know. I have no recollection of my first 6 years at all. I have no connection with my dad. I have nothing. And it must not have been nice because my mother never mentioned his word, never mentioned his name. And when I if I ever asked her, you know, like anything about, you know, like who's my dad, I never asked her again. And I asked my grandmother about him, and my grandmother says, you better talk to your mother. So whatever it was, it wasn't good, you know. I think I suffered from attention deficit disorder when I was a young man, and because I suffered from attention deficit disorder as an old man. I have a real problem with this head of mine, because when I get started with something, it wants to do something else, and that guy wants to do something else, and that guy wants to do something else, and I got a hell of a time, you know, just trying to stay with just one thing, you know. And it was real bad to begin with. I can shut that. But I didn't know that they had a committee. And AA, the first one I actually heard about the committee was a guy named Bobby Earle. And this was like way back in 1986. And he's a nut, you know. He's really, really, really nuts. And I really, really understood what he was talking about, you know. I've been raised by nurtured women. Like I said, I didn't have a father. I had my mother married a guy, and we moved from Boston down to Rhode Island when I was four. And I guess from the day that I grew up and met this man, it's been nothing but a hassle, you know. We never got along, and we were always at odds with each other, and I never bonded with him. The only thing I bonded with was my aunts and my grandma and my nana. And it's amazing how, you know, when you look at when you do your fourth step and you're doing, going back into, you know, like, doing your fourth step, and you become aware of so much stuff, you know, like things that I didn't know why. When Francis hugs me, I got to count to 10, because I just don't want to be hung on to, you know. I feel like I'm trapped, and I try to get over it, and I can't, you know. I never could figure out why I did that until I got into my fourth step. I'm Little Dickie Dickens. I'm the cutest little guy you have ever seen in your life. And I'm in Massachusetts, and I got sailor suits on, and all of my aunts and my nana and my grandmother, they all hug you, and they won't let you go. And they smell like perfume. You know, it just drives me crazy, you know. And I can see, Nana used to, in order to put me to sleep, she would rock me in a rocking chair and hang on to me. And when Nancy and Thelma and my other aunts come by, they would, oh, how cute this little kid is, like this little one over here, the women. It's the same thing like this little guy over here, you know, this new baby, you know, all you women, you want to, oh, how cute he is, you know. Whack, you know, they hang on to you, you know. And you can't, you're suffocating with a perfume, right? And you say, all I'm trying to do is get away, you know. And my sponsor said, you got to chill out, Rick. You know, you got to overcome this character defect. And he says, count to 10. Oh, really? You know? So my last wife, one of my last wives, you know, she grabs a hold of me. And I'm standing there mentally counting. And she says, what are you doing? I said, I'm counting to 10. Why? So you let me alone. I didn't have to worry about her hanging on to me no more, you know. I have a problem with, I have always had a problem with rules, okay? I think a lot of you can understand that. You know, like when I was in grammar school, I managed to make it through the first grade here in Rhode Island, and they determined that it was really would be really beneficial for the town of North Kingston school system and Richard Dickens to go to Catholic school with the nuns. So they transferred me into Catholic school for grades 2 through 10. And I stayed with the nuns for eight, nine years. And I thank God for that, you know. I really do, because I had three nuns that nurtured me, kind of. I had Mother Bernice that was my savior. And you know, have you ever seen, well, I have the same thing. My daughter, when she was real small, she would hang on to my leg, you know, and she was always right beside me. And girls have a tendency to do that. Well, that was me with Mother Bernice. You know, I was always right up against her, unless I was getting into some kind of trouble, you know. And when I got into trouble, she would give me to either Sister Bernice, who would sit me up on the counter and talk to me and tell me, you cannot do this, and this is why. And she would keep at it until I cried. Or she would send me to Sister Philomena Mary, and she'd beat the shit out of me. With rulers, you know, Lincoln log cabin, you know, building sets or whatever, you know. And I love Mother Bernice, you know. And it never dawned on me that she was the one that was imposing all of this stuff on me. And I would have to become, you know, I think I grew up and got some sense of it, you know, and it never really dawned on me until I got old enough, and it's crazy. I went in service. I learned how to drink in Germany. I had my first blackout in Germany. And that one lasted we celebrated my 21st birthday. And 5 days later, I woke up. And I'd been moving all of those 5 days. Went to work up there in the motor pool and driving vehicles and went out partying at night. Drove 12 miles in a German road and did it in 10 minutes to get some boys home. Swallowed a steering wheel in a Volvo. Wiped out all of my teeth. We were having fun. Came back to the States, and when I came back, I used to go down to the bar. And I understand this book, it says when you drink for effect. Because when I came back to Rhode Island and I went out with the family and we went out to the bars, I would drink Narragansett beer that was like swill. And you put a shot of gin in it with just dropped a glass in, you know, the whole thing. And by the time you did two of them, that stuff was really good. And I understood in the book, you know, like, I think I have a problem. I had two jobs. I worked. That's another thing too. My dad and I, when I was growing up, he was always comparing me with my sister. Why can't you be like Marjorie? Why can't you learn how to do your multiplication? Why can't you learn how to do your ABCs? Why can't you do this? And I say, because I'm not Marjorie. And that didn't work, you know, because he was bound and determined that he was going to make me the person that I should be. And I was bound and determined that he wasn't, you know. And it was really hell going up like that. I left when I was about 12, and my family took care of me, and I was more or less on my own. And I started drinking at about 17, and I was 4'11" in senior high school, and I had to grow a half an inch so that the Army would accept me. And they had to give me that quarter of an inch by the time I got there to get me into the service. It was either that or Boys Reform School. And so they allowed me to go into the service and get out of town. just once I started drinking, you never knew what was going to happen, you know, like, and I didn't know what was going to happen either, you know, and it was really bad. I had a child, a young boy, my first child with a marriage, and I couldn't stay out of the bars. I worked a swing shift. I worked for a day shift for Bostitch Corporation. I had a second job at a gas station doing mechanic work. But on the way home, there was about five bars and pool tables. When this book talks about alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful, the only thing that the bars, I used to shoot pool. I never went to the bar to drink beer. I went to the bar to shoot pool. And then naturally, you got to drink beer, you know. It's either that, you can't be a Coca-Cola cowboy, you know, because then you got to fight your way out of the bar. So it was easy to just drink the beer, you know. But then, you know, that's like I never knew I was going to be home or what time I was going to get home or if I could quit or because by the time I got through three or four bars, well, you know how that is. It's just so well. You know, and my wife at that time and the little boy, they stayed with me and you know, it just didn't kind of bother her, but it bothered me. I knew that I had a problem and I had to do something, so I moved to California. I worked for Bostitch Corporation in Rhode Island, and I knew that they had a plan out here, so I moved to California, and I took my wife, and then I had two children with me, too, because Mike was born, and we moved across country with a 19-foot U-Haul trailer. I had Ricky with me in the front seat. She had Michael in the car following behind us, and the dog was up front with me. And then in the afternoon, we would get back together, and the dog would be riding in the car in the back, dragging a deal, and we had the kids and everybody. And we just came to California and started over. And that worked for about a year. And in the book, on pages 164, in the back of that, and it has a vision for you. And the vision for you is, it says that above the paragraph that they always read, Father Fred told me that I needed to read that deal. And that one paragraph above that says that you will create a fellowship that will sustain you with the help of God. Okay, and we never read that in anything, you know, and I looked at that, and that really got to me. I get to create my own fellowship that's going to sustain me in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's supposed to be able, with his help, I can overcome everything that comes my way, and I did that. But you know, prior to that, I created a fellowship of drinkers. Because that's all, you know, I'm not good with normal people that, you know, they just, after work, they go home. If you got a committee like I got a committee, you got to be doing something, you know, because it just drives you crazy. It's always you got to do something. And sitting home watching TV is not the answer, you know, not unless you got something to take the edge off. I loved your story, you know. You told my story the way I think and feel and what happens to me, too, and before I got here. I've had a loving God that's been in working in my favor for all of my life, but I didn't know that because when I was with the Catholic nuns, I didn't have a loving God. I had a God that was a controlling God, and that's how they used to tell me, Richard, if you hit one of us, God's going to send a bolt of lightning out of the sky and strike you dead. Wow. We were out in the playground. George Kurzak and I got into a hassle, and he had me pinned to the ground and choking the crap out of me. And I mean, I was actually going out. I could just kind of like feel myself going back up. And Mother Bernice grabbed a hold of him and picked him up off of me. And I came up and I swung at him and missed him and hit it right in the tit. Really, yeah. I'm about 9 years old, right? And have you ever seen, you just take the wind right out of you, believe me, you know? I have screwed up big time, you know? And I'm looking up there waiting for that bolt of lightning to come out, and I'm looking at that bolt of lightning, and I look her in the eye, and I said, "You lied." And I was glad. And I never hit her again, you know. That was it. It's some of us silly stories, you know. In 1979, I had a drunk driving. I got a DUI in 1979, and the court system sent me to College of Sequoias, and we did a drunk driving class. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why in the hell they didn't figure out, you know, like, take into consideration tolerance. I mean, it's not the first beer that kills you. It's like 10 or 11, you know, like, and I'm sitting here literal. I'm a literal person, you know, and I say, that's a bunch of crap, you know. But I only have X amount of classes to go to, and so I graduate. And upon graduation, the instructor tells me, she says, "Richard, it was really glad to have you here with us, and you've been an inspiration to me." And I say, "Well, thank you." And she says, "We'll see you again." I said, "No, you won't." "No, you won't." 364 days later, I get stopped in downtown Visalia, and I go back to see her. And I, you know, have you ever walked into A? It's like your friend says, you know, how you say you walk in, and everybody says, "Hey, welcome back. You know, I'm glad to see you. Yay!" You know, I walked in the door. She says, "Hello, Richard. How are you?" You know, I said, "I told you." I said, "Yeah, I'm back." You know, and God, let me tell you, man. But it was always, in those days, it was fun being in, back in the old days, you know, there wasn't no P classes and drug tests and counseling, and, you know, you paid your fine, you know, you went to jail, you went to road camp, and you went out in the ditches and you cut some stuff, you know, and slept it off. Yeah. The first time when I arrived at the road camp out here on Road 102, I threw my beer out about 500 yards from the road camp. You talk about a drunk leaning like this, walking to trying to keep up with himself. Well, that's the way I arrived in there. And they got this great big long barracks. I don't know if any of you guys or girls have ever been in any older, but a great big long barracks with a bunch of beds in there, right? And I come rolling in there, and I'm running up there, and Sergeant Garcia is down the other end of the hall, and he's looking at me, and every step I took to this guy, his eyes got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I get up there, and he says, "Can I ask you a question?" "Yeah." "Have you been drinking?" Talk about the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You bet I've been drinking, you know. I just threw my last beer out. And he says, "Get that bed and don't move." Okay. You know, guess what, I came here because everybody told me, you know, like, I asked all my friends, right, my drinking friends, "What do you do when you go to road camp?" "Take a book, take along some cards, because you're going to be spending a couple days out there, and all you got to do is sleep." Wow. How cool is that? You know, my alcoholic bad's already got it made out. I can drink till 6 in the morning, drink all day long, and recover. Right? And Sunday, I get to recover because I got to go to work Monday. God, this is nice, you know? And God, see here, they didn't understand, you know, and I don't know, this is another a miracle of God working in my favor, right? Because when he told me to get in that bed and not move, I didn't, you know, for at least 10 hours. I wake up and everybody asks me, you know, like, "How the hell did you do that?" "Do what?" He puts everybody else in jail. He says, "He puts you in bed." You know, I said, "Have no clue." I said, I've never met the man in my life, you know. And I go, just another miracle, you know. The second miracle that I had was in when I went to the second DUI class. One of the guest speakers that came in, and this is in 1983 now, okay? And I got sober in 1984. One of the guest speakers was a guy named Ziggy, and he had his wife Gloria with him. And Ziggy was an alcoholic, and Gloria was an Al-Anon, black belt, okay? And I connected with that guy right there that night. In 1983 in November, I connected with him simply by listening to him share his story. He described the bar, he described how it smelled, how it felt, how when you hear the click of that can, that pop top, and the click of the balls. And I knew that he knew from experience, not from book knowledge, right? This is not a technical issue. This is really experience. And I said, wow, this guy is really cool. But I was watching Gloria, and every time Gloria looked at Ziggy, she had this big grin on her face. And I wondered, how in the world he conned her into doing that? You know, because that's what I came out of. It's the only thing I ever wanted when I got into AA, before I got here, was in school. All I wanted to do was have my wife smile at me. So after the meeting, I asked him, you know, like, hey, bud, can I ask you a question? He says, yeah, what's that? I says, how did you con your old lady into smiling at you like that? And he just kind of looked at me. He said, can I ask you a question? Yeah. Okay, what? How much do you drink? What the hell does that have to do with it? That's what I asked him. What the hell does that have to do with it? He says, if you want to have your wife smile at you like my wife smiles at me, would you go to AA with me? Yeah. It's okay with me. You know, had no clue what AA was. But I was busy. All right? I got this committee that's running me nuts, and I ain't got time to go to AA because I got all of this other stuff to take care of. I mean, I got a marriage that's going down a tube. I've got $200,000 worth of real estate that I'm trying to take care of that I can't get taken care of because for one reason or the other, and I couldn't figure out what's the matter with it. I have a business at Exeter that's going down a tube, according to my wife, but according to my CPA, she says, you guys are doing really well. You're making pretty good money down there. And I want to know where the hell it's at, because it ain't coming my way, you know. Real estate's going down a tube, you know, the whole shit's going down a tube. And man, let me tell you, in April the 2nd, on a Sunday, well, actually, it was Saturday when I went out. We went up to Elderwood up here, and they were roasting my friends, my beer-drinking fellowship, okay? They were going to have a big pig roast up there and put them in the ground, and it sounds interesting, you know? I'd never seen a pig in the ground with a roast, you know? And so we went up there, and we had a couple of beers. And Sunday morning I wake up and my wife tells me, she says, you're about the saddest son of a gun I ever knew. You were rotten nasty when you come home last night. I said, you're a full of crap. You know, I was just a little light. I mean, I didn't have nothing to drink. I said, and she just kept at it, you know, picking at me, you know. And I said, you know what? If you want to see what drunk is, I'm going to show you. And that Sunday, I showed her, and I died. my higher power, you could say, was that I worked for a company, Bostich, and I had 27 people that I was in charge of in the manufacturing outfit. And I couldn't go to work being drunk because all of these 27 people were dependent upon me. Right, so that kept me going. But that Sunday, when I got drunk, I couldn't get up Monday, and I couldn't make it to work, and I had lost my last barrier. I had hit my bottom. That was my bottom right there. When I couldn't take care of my 27 people, I mean, that was it. And I called Ziggy on a Monday. Ziggy, well, it was kind of funny, because When he picked up the phone, he says, hello. And I said, it's me. And he goes, "Gloria, it's him." I knew he was coming. The perfect description of me when I first got here was the lights was on, there was nobody home. You know, I just sitting like numb, you know, and I had a wall up in front of me like you would not believe, because I was right on the verge of going out, you know, and all I had to do was just protect me. I had a ring on my finger, and it had an R on it for Richard, and I would sit there in meetings in the first couple of months in the meetings, and all I would do was look at that ring and keep looking at that ring, and I kept telling myself, "You're still here. You're still here." And Ziggy was right beside me. My sponsor was right beside me. And when I'd start getting shaky or nothing, he'd touch me and hold me. And I'd look at that ring. And I'd say to myself, "You're still here." You know, that's how close I came to going up. God once again came in. One of the major things that got to me, too, on that Monday when I talked with Ziggy, he says, I belong to the union, and I'm like a high mucky mucks in the union, and I have to go to San Francisco this week on this union business, and I want to know if you can hang on until next Monday, until I can get here and be with you. And naturally, you know, Superman, I got my cape in full flow, and I said, "Absolutely," you know. And he says, "But what I want you to do is I want you to go to the Alano Club Wednesday, and I want you to check in, and I want you to contact somebody. I want you to talk to Sammy and tell her who you are, tell her that I sent you, and he'll take care of you." And I said, "Okay." So I went to the Alano Club upstairs in Charlie's Shoe Shop, and this was in 1984, and it was kind of fun. I have a tendency, I've been a machinist for a long time, and I do a lot of production work, and I'm always counting numbers, you know. You get paid by the amount of work you do or the amount of pieces you can make or whatever, and you got to know where you are constantly during that period of time on how many numbers you got, right? So when I walk in the Alano Club in there and I open up the door and this thing is going upstairs and I count the stairs. 12 steps. How cool, you know? And at the top of this, they got this sign up there and it says, "Just 12 more steps." Wow, you know, I was there for like 6 months, you know, and I, every time I look at it, I say, "Geez, I wonder what the hell that sign is," you know. That's another one of my problems, you know. I don't want to look stupid, right? So you don't ask the simple question, right? You meditate on it. Now you got 9 assholes up here, and they're all meditating on, "I wonder what that next 12 steps is," you know. Drive you crazy, you know. I never did ask, really. I kind of finally figured that one out by myself. It kept me busy. It kept those fools occupied, you know. God thank you, you know. And I had another one too. And what? I've been married 5 times, and I've been divorced 5 times, and I have a problem with staying married with women. I can't figure them out, you know. So naturally, when I got sober, being a bachelor, I had a lot of room in my homes. And one of the nicest things that this God that loves me, he has always filled my home with other people. Or he even did it one time when my sponsor told me, "Rick, it's time for you to learn how to be by yourself. Okay? I want you to go and get some VCR movies and I want you to stay in your home, and I want you to get comfortable with yourself watching VCR movies. And I say, you've got to be kidding. He says, no, I mean that. I went to the Ulano Club on a Saturday, and he says, I want you to go to the movie and the matinee on a Saturday afternoon, and I want you to go by yourself. Really? Yeah, you're just by yourself, okay? Now, I'm willing to do, you know, to go to any lengths. And so I go to this movie by myself, but I really cheated because I asked all the guys. The guys didn't want to go to the movie. And then I asked a couple of the girls, and they didn't want to go to the movies either. So I said, well, screw. I must, you know, this ain't going to work. So I went to the movies. Can't tell you what the movie was. I sat there by myself, man, just trying to get through it, you know. But I made it. So then he says, I want you to take some VCR tapes and go home, because I explained to him, you know, about how I felt with this movie episode. It was really not good, you know. It didn't do me any good. He says, okay, so we'll do this. We'll try something else. So that's how we went into the VCR movie. This loving God that I had, this little girl across the way that I lived in the apartments, she had this Siamese cat. Mister, beautiful cat, one of those golden brown Siamese with their black socks on it, you know. And she would take that cat and hang him over the banister on the second floor and drop him. You know, and I told her one time about that, and she was a little ornery sucker, you know. So like she just like told me, you take. I'm gonna tell your mother if you don't stop that. Okay, you know. So I told her mother, and mother didn't say nothing. Kids still kept doing it. So then Mr. used to come running over to my house, and he'd come into my place. And he'd hide underneath the couch. And they'd come over, and they'd say, have you seen my cat? No. They'd take off, and Mr. would leave after a while, right? You know, so then that one time when I'm there with my VCR movies, I look out the window like that, and here she is. You know, she dropped that damn cat off the deal. And when he hit the ground, he was boogieing for me, you know. And he come rocking and rolling in there, pulled up beside me on a couch. And me and that cat watched movies for 6 months. I was not alone again. I moved up into Willow Street, and the girls in AA told me that we got a problem, and you have a friend over in Porterville, and she needs to, she can't stay sober. She needs to come over to Visalia. Can you do anything? I said, well, I don't know. I said, you know, like, Judy, what's, you're like, what's, she's got kids, right? And she says, yeah, she's got three little kids. And what do you want me to do? Well, you know, you got a house, you know, can you spare rooms or whatever, you know? So I said, okay, so she said, but you got to go get her. So, okay, you know, so I get on my motorcycle and I go over to Porterville, and I knock on Judy's door, and she's strung out, you know. And she looked at me and she says, you got to come back in an hour. And I did, you know, and I don't know what the hell she did for that hour, but she was straight by then. Well, I got straight one time like that doing Benzedrine on top of a blackout. That was like 5 days of up trucking coming over the deal. But we went out first thing in the morning on New Year's in L.A. and my Army buddy, and he said, come on, we'll go down to the Iron Horse and shoot a couple games of pool. Yes, you know. And we went down there, we shot a couple games of pool, and he dragged me home. Picked me up and carried me into the apartment, and we're supposed to go out with the wives at night, and they saw us coming in, and they goes, oh, shit, there goes our night. You know, we're not going out. And Bud hauls me into the bathroom, and he said he gave me a Benzedrine, and I came out sober. I don't think it was only one, you know. I got drunk on top of the drunk. coming over the grapevine 3 days after that, I'm still dry heaving in a bag. I know there was more than one Benny in that sucker, you know, like, and it wasn't the booze that got me, it was that damn Benzedrine pill. That cured me of drugs, okay? I was doing fine with alcohol. In 1984, I was right on the edge of being duly addicted, you know. When they wanted to do drugs, I said, no way. I've been cured of that stuff, you know. And that stuff will kill you, you know. Anyway, back to Judy. So Judy came up. We picked her up and we brought her home. And this is the loving God again working in my favor, because I had divorced from my wife and I lost my three children. And God gave me three more children. And Judy stayed with me. Oh, we stayed together for, I don't know, about almost a year. And the kids, you know, they were doing fine. She was doing fine. Everybody sobered up. And it was really nice, you know. And I drove a motorcycle. And I've been driving motorcycle for a long time with the Midnighters and the Sequoia Riders. And we didn't ride motorcycles. We went bar hopping from one bar to the other all the way out to, you know, I had in my motorcycle, I had bags and I had holes drilled in the motorcycle bags so you could put ice in it so you could keep the beer cold, you know. And we went, they made me road captain, and we were headed out towards Cutler and Rossi, and we were going up in the mountains, and I had the audacity to take these guys and drive all the way to Cutler without a stop. And they were going to do something surgically with my anatomy if I did that again, you know. And that was like 12 miles. You couldn't go 12 miles, you know, without stopping. And that was unheard of, you know. And I look back at that today, God, you know, like, can't believe it. Come out of Yosemite, get stopped. Highway patrol's there. Me and my girlfriend about half smashed. I get off the motorcycle and I'm looking back at my motorcycle and there's dripping water coming out of the cycle, out of the bag, you know. I'm going, oh God, you know, I hope he doesn't say anything, you know. And he looks at my license and he says, do you know that you went through that stop sign back there at that T? And I say, what T? He said, well, you know that side road back there that you're supposed to stop at that. I said, I didn't see that side roll. He says, I don't doubt it. You know, he wasn't right by it, you know. And I'm trying to stay, you know, in his line of vision so that he doesn't see that water dripping out of that damn bag, you know. And he steps over to the side like that, and he kind of like glances down. I go, oh, shit, you know, like, he don't say nothing. Just gives me a little old ticket and says, be careful.
Yes.
That don't happen no more. No, not anymore. But that's just that loving God taking care of me again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's been that way all my life. And I didn't realize it, you know, that actually that vengeful God that I had when I was a child was a loving God, because that's exactly what it took to get me from 4 to 12, you know, without going from 12 to 17. I almost went to juvenile retention school in Rhode Island. I was either that or the judge was going to send me to... I had a choice. I was either going to go into the service or I was going to go into reform school, one or the other. And you know, it was not from being a criminal or anything. It's just mischievous. It's just stupid stuff, you know. But it's a lot of that was behind booze. And it's... I should have known, you know, because, you know, well, I say I should have known today, but I didn't know then because, you know, like my father was an alcoholic and I was probably genetically disposed to it. So another thing, too, was when I was a child back in Rhode Island, everybody hung out in the kitchen. When people came visiting, they hung out in the kitchen and they played cards and they went to the local package store. We had, you couldn't go to the, you know, like the bar or whatever to get beer. You had to go to a package store. So Mom and I would go to a package store and get a couple cases, and they'd go back home and have a good time. You know, everybody was happy. And that's what the way I grew up. You know, drinking was a fun thing, you know. 90% of the time, 10% of the time, me and the old man got into the shit again, because when he got drunk, he decided he wanted to play, you know, and I didn't play real well. So, that's another story. When I came to Visalia and I met Ziggy in 1983, I surrendered my first time to alcohol. And I was driving down 198, riding on my motorcycle at 6 o'clock in the morning, headed for the bar. And I knew then that I was not going to the bar to shoot pool. I was going to the bar because I was going to drink beer. And I was so demoralized, too, that I was crying. And all I could think about was I was singing mentally that song, "There Stands the Glass." That will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one today. And I had to pull off the side of the road and stop the motorcycle because I couldn't see. I was crying so bad. And I got over that, wiped my eyes off, got straightened up, got back on the motorcycle and said, "Oh well," that's not what I said. I proceeded then from 1983 to April 2nd, 1984, to just drink. You know, it didn't make any difference. Whatever happened, happened, and that was it. Until I crashed. And thank God that I had backup support with a sponsor. And the fellowship of AA, too, behind me, you know. I had, it was, Monday night we went to Farmersville, and Farmersville back in the, I wish that you people were here then. That was an awesome, awesome meeting. It was a riot, you know. They had people come one time for Frank and Charlene, were the people who run Pine Manor, and they had a birthday party for Frank. And they were flying in from 130 miles away up in San Francisco and Northern California, all over California, to celebrate this birthday for Frank. And they were outside the building. We had a big, you know, building in there. And we were all over the place celebrating this guy's birthday. And, man, it was so cool. And that particular day, I'm still wiped out, you know. I'm brand new and like, it's still all foggy, and I, the only thing I'm doing is hanging on. And for some reason or other, Charlene came over in the middle of that room like this, in the middle of that room standing around, and Charlene come over and hugged me and whispered in my ear. She says, "It's going to be okay." And it was, that was it. That was so cool. A couple of years after that, I was in the old Olano Club after we moved from Charlie's Shoe Shop, and we had this character named Father Fred that'd come along, and Fred was doing book studies, and I would go to the book study with Fred, and I was behind the counter. Albert calls me Rick's Dictionary Rick, you know, and I would have this 1935 dictionary. In fact, it was two of them from 1935. The definition of some of these words that you see in this book here today is not the same definition that went on in 1935. It has changed over the course of the years, and it's just different. But Fred would in there, and he would say, "Rick, well, look up the word itself." So I'd go back there, and I'm behind the counter, and I'd take the dictionary, and I'd look it up. And then that's what we would do with the book, is just explain the words in the book. And then he would read the sentence, and then he would transpose the word into a definition and bring it back out again to make sense of the thing. And I mean, it was, oh God, it was awful nice. You know, it just made sense. And there was something different when I would go there in that Alano Club, and I would sit down, and I don't know. It just, you sit down and it's just different, and you're trying to figure out, you know, like I got nine guys up here trying to figure out what the hell's going on, you know, what's different, and they're nuts, you know, and it went on like that for a couple of 3 days, maybe a week, trying to figure out what the heck's different, you know. So I went in there one day and I sat down, and it was just kind of like. Just kind of like, oh wow, you know, like relax. You just, I could feel every muscle in my body just kind of like, and I go, whoa, this is really cool, you know. And I get up and I walk out that door, and man, I'll tell you, the wall went back up, and the protection came on, and the muscles all tightened up, you know, and I was protecting myself again from the society that I had made. I didn't want to see that. I am the direct cause of 90% of the shit that happens to me. And I had to find that out. Thank God, you know. One of the major things I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous was discover, uncover, and discard. And I don't know if they go exactly that way. It might be uncover, discover, and discard, but it doesn't make any difference which way you put it. It works, you know. And I became of my triggers. I spent almost a month one time on a simple question that my sponsor asked me. And he said, Rick, why do you drink? I want you to go home, and I want you to work on this, and I want you to come back like next week and next Sunday, and I want you to tell me why you drink. I said, okay. So I went home, and I did my thing, and I came back, and I had a bunch of things that I wrote down. And he says, okay, what do you got? So I start reading off, and he says, that's not what I asked you. He says, those are excuses. I want to know why, I want you to know why you drink. So go back and let's do this again. You'll work on it during the week. Next Sunday you come back over here and we'll go over it again. So I go back and I make up some more things. You know, this is, I go back and sit down with him and I would start reading him out, and he says, that's not what I asked you, Rick. Those are reasons. You gave me excuses, and you gave me reasons, and that's not what I want you to understand. That's not the answer. I want you, and I want you to know, why do you drink? So I go back, and I start it again. And I'm mad. And I open up the book. And they tell me that the program of recovery and all the answers are in pages 1 through 164. You can take pages 1 through 164 and stick them. I am not going to read pages 1 through 164. I open the book up and they got Roman numerals in here. And I think I'll just read the Roman numerals. And the Roman numerals are the doctor's opinion. And in the doctor's opinion, it states very specifically that an alcoholic by nature is restless, irritable, and discontented. And I read that about 3 or 4 times, and I knew why I drank. Because God imposed it upon me in my thinking and my feeling, and I knew that the answer to why I drank was because I am restless. in pages 23, and then I even opened up to 1 through 164, you know, and I'm reading, kind of browsing through in there, and on pages 1 through 164, it talks about a little word there. It talks about meandering. Alcoholics have a tendency to meander. Or in other words, you're just kind of like, you don't have any specific reason to go someplace. You're just kind of like floating around, you know, and you end up in a bar. You know, that's a damn, you know, and the connection between pages 23 and that doctor's opinion, being restless, irritable, and disconnected and meandering, I'd say, wow, you know, like, so I go back and I tell Ziggy, I think I got it, you know. And he says, congratulations. He says, how did you figure that out? And I said, I didn't. I said, read the doctor's opinion. He says, good boy. It just, it took a lot. How are we doing on time? 2 more minutes? It took a lot for me to hear God. He would have to hit me with 2x4, you know, in order to. And over the course of time, I have learned to listen to him through my feelings and my thinking, you know, and his protection. I come rolling out of Exeter, and I come up to the stop sign and the red light, and I get on 198. And man, I'll tell you what, from internal Exeter to that red light, I am ready to get on it. All I want to do is just, I'm willing to pay the price of 100 miles an hour, okay? And I'm going to do 100 miles an hour when I go about 198. And I pull out there and I straighten up and I get on it. And he says, Rick, this is a cop on road 180. I heard the voice. There's a cop on 180. And I let off the thing, and I'm thinking, you know, like, and I come up over the hill like that, and I come down out there, and there's the cop sitting right there. I heard the voice, and I go, wow, how cool, you know. He did that the second time coming out of Farmersville. Being an alcoholic, I said, that was lucky, you know, it was really cool, but, you know, it won't happen again. So when I came out of Farmersville, you come up over the highway and come down around the curve to come out of 198, and I'm driving again, and I said, when I come down that curve, I'm going to come rock and rolling out of that boy. When I hit 198, I am going for it. And I come down around that curve like that, and he said it again, Rick, look on the hill. What? Look on the hill. And I glanced back like that, and here's the highway patrol. And he's just ready to jump. And I let off the fuel. I come putting out on 198. And when I went down 198, he pulled up alongside me on the frontage road, and he goes, and I say, that's it. It's not going to take that to listen, you know. I got it, you know, and everything changed from that. I could hear God. I know when he talks to me. I know when he's protecting me, and it's been like that for 34 years. You're a miracle. I loved your story, and thank you. I'm glad I was here for you. You were here for me. Thank you.